Hello, and welcome to Good People to Know, a Down to Earth podcast brought to you by WFI Insurance. We round up experts, specialists and people in the know from around Australia and talk to them about things that matter most to regional Australians. With spring upon us, many regional communities' thoughts are turning to preparation for bushfire season. With climate change causing an increase in the frequency and severity of bushfires in Australia, there's a pressing need to reduce emissions and find new ways to make communities resilient. In today's episode, I speak with Sean Apu from the Aboriginal Carbon Foundation, who use traditional burning methods to reduce the impact of bushfires and the emissions they cause. Working with traditional owners and organisations like the Aboriginal Carbon Foundation, landowners can not only make their farms more resilient to fire, but also earn carbon credits that they can invest back into their business. Welcome, Sean. I'd like to start by asking about who the Aboriginal Carbon Foundation is.
The Aboriginal Carbon Foundation is a not-for-profit organisation. We've been around for about 12 years. We are majority Aboriginal people controlled, and the majority of our staff are Aboriginal people as well. So we have predominantly worked in the northern parts of the country. So when it comes to carbon farming, there are 38 different methodologies at this point in time. And mostly we've worked with one of those methodologies, which is called savanna burning. And savanna burning is contained within two different rainfall bands across the top part of the country. So Northern West Australia, Northern Territory, and Cape York and far north Queensland. And it's a technique that's based on traditional Aboriginal burning, so using cool burns. And the way that the methodology is rolled out by the Clean Energy Regulator in this country is you have to conduct cool burns between the 1st of April and the 1st of September. And then if you can get around and do as many burns as you can during those months, then theoretically that will reduce the incidence of wildfire during the hotter, drier months. And so most of the properties where people are doing the savanna burning methodology, there still are some wildfires, but what you hope for is that the emissions that you reduce or the fires that you put in during those cooler months severely restricts the amount of fuel that's available for burns during those hotter months. And then the projects get paid for that gap between the low emissions that they produce during cool burns and the bigger emissions that they stop from happening. So it's all algorithm and calculation based. It just uses satellite technology to see when burns were done, where they were done, and how much country got covered during those cooler months.
So Sean, can you tell me how these practices would have been used traditionally to manage the land?
Yeah, so fires are a real tool for a lot of Indigenous people. So we're very diverse people. So there were over 300 nations across the country and over 500 languages spoken. So, you know, we all had different cultures and different languages and different scientific knowledges and different seasonal calendars. So it was very varied in a lot of different places. But fire seems to have been one practice that was predominant across all the different nations, and it was used for a range of different reasons, to support biodiversity, to sort of manage country, to make sure that ecosystems were well functioning, and that it looked after the whole of the ecosystem. So it's a really holistic practice within Indigenous cultural knowledges. And what we see through our partner, the Fire Sticks Alliance, a lot of the work in cultural fire practice revitalisation that they've been conducting over a long period of time, they see a lot of cultural revitalisation that goes on through the work that they've been doing. So, you know, people haven't had opportunities to come together and to work in this way for a long, long period of time. And now they see through these kinds of programs, people are talking about bits and pieces of their culture from their own knowledge. And so they're sort of putting things together. They're sort of re-piecing this jigsaw without having a sort of picture to work from, which is really, really interesting. And then from a social impact point of view, having lots of different generations walking country, talking about protocols, talking about a whole range of different things. There's lots of really positive social impacts that comes from this work as well. So it's a very important practice that we feel very strongly in working with the Fire Sticks Alliance to be able to reinvigorate across large tracts of countryside.
And I understand that you're expanding a bit more broadly. Do cultural practices differ depending on country?
They do, and it's mainly around, like I said, the sort of cultural protocols that each different nation observes. Like, there might be different totem systems, and totem systems can incorporate lots of environmental elements. It can be birds, it can be plants, it can be winds, it can be weather systems. So they kind of vary vastly across the whole country. So, you know, the cultural fire practice is quite different in lots of different places as well. So it kind of ranges from the, you know, what the initial purpose is to what the outcomes are to who's involved. You know, sometimes it can be split along gender lines. So women are responsible for burning section parts or certain sections of country, and men are responsible for the others. There are places where, you know, implementing burning practice is used as a training mechanism. So there are those sort of training grounds, because people know that it's reasonably safe to put in burns in that country, then it's not going to get out of control. So it's very varied depending on where you're coming from, what the ecosystem mix is, what the plant life are, what the animal species, and generally just what the country looks like.
So what's different between a traditional burn as distinct from a hazard reduction burn by your local rural fire service?
So we did some work in the last couple of years with the Fire Sticks Alliance in putting together this philosophy and guidelines for an environmental commodity that we launched with them earlier this year called the Cultural Fire Credit. There's a whole sort of 70-page document that has the underlying philosophy behind that. And when I was looking at it last week, it really goes through the different kinds of fires that there are. So from hazard reduction burns, conservation burns, Savannah fire management, which is that carbon credit methodology that I mentioned just before, and then cultural fire management as well. So there are, it sort of goes into great detail, and mainly the biggest differences between hazard reduction and cultural fire management is around the primary purpose. So hazard reduction is obviously about reducing bushfire risk, and cultural burns are about maintenance of protocols and ceremony and law, and giving people who are the traditional owners and custodians for that land, giving them responsibility for looking after their country. So that's the differences around purpose. The differences around outcome can be around, so for hazard reduction burns, it's about reducing the risk of loss of life and property. And for cultural fire management, it's around, you know, maintaining the health of country. So making sure that country is healthy and that different parts of that ecosystem aren't getting out of balance. And then there's a lot more detail that sort of goes into it, particularly around tools. You know, tools and methods can be quite varied. But I think one of the biggest ones is around how those fires are then validated, so we can be able to assess what the impact of putting those burns in, but also what the results are. So with hazard reduction burns, it's mainly through satellite mapping or aerial mapping plus on-the-ground monitoring. So you've got the people who are putting the burns in, and then later on you can go back and be able to sort of map more accurately using satellites the area that was burnt. Whereas for cultural fire practice, it's more about people being able to get on back onto the country and go, okay, this is where we burnt, this is what we saw. You can see how high those flames came up some of the trees, and it's usually not more than waist height. And then you're able to see, you know, what kind of animals have come back after you put the burn in. And then as far as results might go, you know, we've seen over the years a few hazard reduction burns that have gotten out of control and turned into larger fires. That doesn't happen with cultural burns. You know, there's usually people there watching it. Like, there's usually people walking around barefoot during some of those burns. Like, that's how low and sort of slow some of these fires are. Like, they really do just crawl along. They give animals plenty of time to get out. Well, it produces minimal smoke. So they are very vastly different fire practices. One has thousands and thousands of years of knowledge behind it. And the other one's something that's been relatively new in the landscape in less than 100 years.
Yeah, I was just going to go there, Sean, and sort of ask, how do these practices, which are tens of thousands of years old, reduce carbon emissions in modern Australia?
So since we've been selling the cultural fire credits, I've been doing some research into, like, what the economic business model is for someone like, why would somebody buy one from an economic point of view? We think the sort of social and environmental impact sort of stacks up, but financially we have to look at it. And, you know, the 2019 bushfires seems like a distant memory now, because we've had, you know, global pandemics, and we've had a couple of flood events since then, but it won't be too long before bushfires will be front of mind again once a lot of the water's dissipated and we've had some sun to be able to regrow the kinds of fuel that those bushfires feed on. But, you know, there was, I think from the 2019-2020 bushfires, some of the evidence I saw was that there were a whole year of carbon emissions released into the atmosphere from that six-week event. So that's nationwide, all of the carbon that would have been released from the whole country's, you know, doing business has been released in that 6 weeks period. So, you know, if we continue to let that situation happen annually or even every couple of years, like, we're really going to struggle to meet, you know, our own national and global targets to reduce emissions. But then if you have a look at the sort of biodiversity loss, so 3 billion animals perished during that time. Even on social media, like all the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people I was connected with around the country using Twitter and things like that, a lot of them are talking about trauma. Their country was burning. Their totem systems were, you know, animals perished. Some of those ecosystems are going to take a long, long time to be able to put back together again, to be able to bring them back to that healthy state. So bushfires do a real lot of damage. I think nearly 3,000 homes and properties were burnt. 30 people died. You know, but we have solutions to be able to work better on our country and to be able to minimise bushfire risk. I think what we're lacking is a bit of local and national will to be able to implement programs that can benefit all of us.
Yeah, and you've touched on there the amount of carbon released through those bushfires. You know, as you said, a catastrophic event and affected a number of communities and across multiple states. Do you have any knowledge of how these practices help reduce emissions?
Yeah, so because the fires are so low, like, they really are small fires that are really slow moving, like, they sort of crawl through the landscape. And as I said earlier, if you see bushfires moving, those things, like, the flames are enormous. They're above the tree canopy. They're moving at, you know, 40 to 60 or even faster kilometres an hour. So, you know, animals can't get away. Trees are just vaporized. So all of the carbon that tree has been storing over years and years and years just gets released. So if we can implement fires that produce much smaller amounts of fire, that actually burn less fuel loads, they get rid of all of the fuel load that's on the ground, but they're not getting into canopies and vaporising leaves, particularly eucalyptus leaves. And when you see those big eucalypt trees, they just go up like bombs in bushfires. So, you know, if we can reduce the amount of fuel that's on the ground to let bushfires take hold, then we will be able to stop the amount of carbon that gets released in the atmosphere by just doing annual low, slow cultural burns.
You're right, Sean, when you talk about the speed at which those bushfires do move, and when the fire gets up in the canopy with the eucalyptus leaves, it almost becomes impossible to stop. So, yeah, really, really challenging. So, beyond emission reduction, what are some of the other benefits for communities?
For Indigenous people, being able to get back out on country and walk that country and reconnect with it and have a greater understanding for what that country is to them, and to let them fit back into that landscape, I think there's a lot of social and cultural benefits for that kind of work. What we discuss when we talk with people, when we talk with traditional owners about reinvigorating cultural practice around using fires, is that, you know, after a couple of years of getting back out into the country and doing those fire programs, you end up with a lot of really well-educated people from the community about what that country is and what that country does. And then, you know, with that knowledge, you can implement things like cultural tourism businesses. So during the hotter months, when you can't do any burns, you could be taking tourists out of the country and talking with them about how that landscape operates, how the ecosystem is this balance of all the different factors that make up that ecosystem. You know, you can get school kids back out there. You can run some school programs to be able to introduce people or sort of reconnect people with their environment. I think a lot of the issues we have at the moment around climate change is that people can't really conceptualise what climate change is, because we've all become disconnected from the land. We, you know, we buy all of our food and groceries from major supermarket chains, and we don't really know, you know, what that food relates to. We don't really know enough about, you know, farming practices in this country. So, you know, I think by having people get back out into nature and reconnect with nature, I think only good can come from it.
So, you know, the benefits are broad and really support, you know, the entire community.
It does, yeah. So even if you want to look at it from a bushfire mitigation point of view, you know, we don't have entire towns disrupted like we saw in 2019, 2020. You know, we don't see properties and businesses vaporised, because it takes a long, long time for those communities to come back again. Like, I've done some travel down around the Bega Valley in the last 12 months, and I've seen some of those towns. You can see that they're still going through cleanup. There's a lot of people that are still displaced. They don't have homes. So there's a lot of disruption that goes on when bushfires go through and burn towns down, or when they, you know, impact businesses, not just if they just burn forests. There's a lot of social disruption that comes from bushfires. And I think now we're starting to get our heads around not just the human costs, but how important minimising the risks around environmental costs are as well.
With the network expanding, what sort of organisations are you partnering with at the present time?
Aboriginal organisations at the moment. So those Aboriginal organisations are obviously place-based. They're in, you know, not just regional and outback communities. They're also in cities. So we know that some organisations have been doing some work for government agencies in different places and implementing some burns just as a sort of pilot project to be able to do some research around what the impacts of those burns are. But yeah, it's mainly Aboriginal organisations, because, you know, being cultural fire practice, it's about trying to work with those communities to reinvigorate their cultural knowledges around burning and using fire as that tool for their local people. But we're hoping that through the cultural fire credit, like the cultural fire credit itself is a 10-year blind environmental commodity. So, you know, farmers can buy cultural fire credits and link it to their properties and then have a cultural burn conducted on their property. And that could be for a number of reasons. It could be for biodiversity support. It could be for bushfire mitigation. It could just be because they're interested in learning more about cultural fire practice and wanting to be involved. And I guess, you know, the Fire Sticks Alliance have done a really great job over a number of years in making sure that when they conduct cultural burns, they contact the local emergency services, they have regular contact with the local non-Indigenous community. Anybody in those areas is allowed to come along and take part, as long as you take part fully. And for them, it's not just about turning up and lighting something on fire. There's a number of weeks of work that go into mapping the area, looking at what's there, looking at what some of the dangers are, so that you have a really strong sense that the risk has been taken away from conducting these practices in communities and in different landscapes.
Sean, you just answered my next question with the way you responded there. I was going to ask you whether you do any work with the agricultural sector. So thank you, and that's fairly broad. But just to move in a little bit of a different direction, beyond traditional burns, what are some of the other ways you can work with farmers?
So we've been working with mainly cattle farmers in the northern parts of the country. So if there's a pastoral lease that's on a piece of land that also has a native title claim on it, we work to facilitate arrangements if they're not already there, sort of facilitate relationships between traditional owners and those farmers. Some of the farmers are already, like, they're already privy to some carbon development methodologies that might work on their properties, so like herd management or weed management or invasive species and feral animal management practices. So we have a particular commodity that we sell called farmer credits, and that is all about working with farmers so that they can just change some of the land management practices that they already have in place, like I said, like herd management. And that's about setting aside some parcels of land so that your cattle aren't grazing over the entire property all of the time. So you might cordon off some sections of land so that the undergrowth and vegetation can come back a bit more vigorously. And then, you know, the next year you can open that up and sort of revegetate what you what you had your cattle feeding on last year. So there's different ways that we're working with farmers to be able to implement some of those practices where they need to, but mainly a lot of our role is around helping to facilitate relationships between traditional owners and farmers.
Sean, thank you. It's been a really fascinating conversation. And just as we do wrap up, how can farmers work with traditional owners to improve the land for all? And if a farmer wants to get in contact about a project, how do they go about that?
I guess there's lots of different ways that farmers can work with traditional owners, you know, even if it's just about giving people jobs on their properties. There's, you know, being able to support local businesses. So, you know, farmers are very, very strong and operating in their local communities and making sure that the money that is made locally stays in that local community, and that's certainly something that we're all about as well. And having relationships with traditional owners who can give them some more information about how to look after country. You know, they've been looking after those pieces of land where there might be some pastoral leases on or other farms. You know, there are direct connections for those people that go back thousands and thousands of years, and they've seen quite a lot. And there's a real depth of information that's contained within traditional knowledge that I think farmers can definitely benefit from. And then there's, you know, if weed management and other feral animals are a real problem, you know, we've seen that there's been a few farmers up in Cape York that have been using cultural fire to be able to help with the management of those two kinds of things. So there's a number of different benefits that come from farmers and traditional owners working together. And I would sort of urge farmers that don't already have a good relationship to reach out to their local traditional owners and try and facilitate some kind of relationship development. Yeah, so to answer your second question, we have a website, so abcfoundation.org.au. It's best to get in touch with us through the website. There's a lot of information on our website, so there's information about the farmer credits and some of the other work that we do. There's also links there to the cultural fire credit information, so you'll be able to get your hands on that guidelines and philosophy document if you want to get some more detailed information about the cultural fire credits or the ways that cultural fire is different from other fire management practices.
Sean, thank you for joining me today. It's been a fascinating conversation. I feel like I could ask you questions for another hour or so, but we have run out of time. But look, thank you very much for joining us today on our WFI podcast series.
No worries. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining me today for this special conversation with Sean Apu. Just like Sean is helping farmers by his traditional knowledge to improve the land and reduce emissions, WFI Insurance has a long and proud history of helping agricultural communities to identify and mitigate their risk, protecting Aussie farms for over 100 years. Please join us again next time as we shake hands with more good people to know.